Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.
I think the only thing that was embarrassing were Marco's comments, I have to say. I completely disagreed with everything he said. If a guy wants to cry after his first race, so be it. These guys are professional athletes, not robots.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen and F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. Lando Norris tamed the chaos in Melbourne to win the opening round of the season. In doing so, he put down a marker to his teammate Oscar Piastri, to his rival Max Verstappen, and anyone else who wants a say in this year's World Championship. F1's 5.5 rookies, Liam Lawson being a sort of semi-rookie, had a pretty torrid time. From Hadjar's tears to Antonelli's vindication, we will analyse the debuts of the class of 25. Meanwhile, as new sponsors and new money pour into F1, Stefano Domenicali has signed a new 5-year contract to remain as F1's CEO. He promptly signed the teams up to a new commercial part of the Concorde Agreement, but there's no sign yet of a governance agreement from the FIA. So what does that mean for the sport? With me to discuss all of these interesting talking points and more, we have Global Editorial Director Rebecca Clancy. How are you doing, Rebecca?
Very well, thank you, but I'm not the one who's jet-lagged.
Well, no, that would definitely be Ben Hunt, fresh-ish,
yeah,
off the plane from Melbourne, Motorsport Editor-in-Chief. Ben, how are you?
Yeah, I'm rubbing my eyes as we're talking, but no, certainly no jet lag here. I was doing the school run this morning, so, you know, we're back on the time zone, all good.
For the purposes of a podcast, you look terrible.
Thank you.
You did take him to the right school, did you?
I think so.
Very good. Very good. Well, listen, I didn't go to Melbourne this year. So please set the scene for us, Ben. I mean, how was the atmosphere and what were the interesting undercurrents you picked up?
So atmosphere-wise, it was fantastic. We always talk about, you know, Australia being a good place to start and kick off the season. You know, the fans there are really what make it. And this year was like no other. Full house, glorious weather up until Sunday. Really, really good fun to see everyone pouring into Albert Park. Also, such diverse fans as well. I go back to, you know, my first experience of the Australian Grand Prix, and it was all very, you know, V8 supercar heavy, predominantly a male audience. Whereas this time, it was completely different. So much younger and female fans. You know, there were makeup brands and stuff advertising and pop-up stalls. It was totally unique to what I'd experienced before in Australia. Last time I was there was the COVID race that obviously didn't happen in 2020. So it was my first time back in a long time, and it was really good to see so much has changed. So much positivity. It just felt right to be kicking off there. So I really, really enjoyed it.
Well, let's start with Norris then. Fifth career win from his 10th career pole. First McLaren driver to lead the Drivers' World Championship for 13 years. What his win in Abu Dhabi did for his confidence, I think, is the big talking point here. When I look at his 24 season, I see a driver who got bullied basically by Max Verstappen, who he gets a ride with on his jet, and he sort of, you know, just felt a little bit that Lando was a little bit too much in Max's pocket at times. Perhaps a harsh thing to say, but he needed to break away from that, but he also needed to put a marker down to Verstappen. And then there were times, as we've discussed previously, where he wasn't ruthless enough in certain situations. And then I think Abu Dhabi last year, it was all on him to bring that win home in order to, for McLaren to win that Constructors' Championship. And you just feel that he grew up through that experience. I don't know what you think, Rebecca, but it seems to me that confidence is obviously a supremely important thing in any sportsman or woman. But you see growth there, don't you?
100%. I thought there was an interesting quote from Norris at the end of last year where he said that he hadn't been ready to fight for the championship. And you saw it. And when you were watching him race last season, you could almost sense he was on edge. You weren't fully confident he was going to pull off the result. You know, he's got 5 race wins from 10 poles. It's not a great conversion, let's say. But there was something about the way that he handled the race in Australia, those closing laps with Max Verstappen breathing down his neck. I was watching it thinking, I don't think he's going to mess this up. He feels like a different driver. It feels like he's had a good winter, got himself prepared, and he's actually ready to be world champion this year. It was a really composed race by driver and team, I thought. You know, interestingly, after Oz, Norris was talking about how the mistakes they made at Silverstone last year, where perhaps they threw it away. And, you know, we can all agree with that. He should have won that race and he didn't. And it's interesting now because to be a champion, you have to win the races that you should win. And he's done that. The other thing he's going to have to do this season is win the races he shouldn't have won. And that's the next thing to get under his belt. But it was a really composed, really confident, very mature drive for him in incredibly, incredibly difficult conditions. You know, he had the same off as Piastri, his teammate, and it ruined Piastri's race. But he was able to just manage that slide off a little bit better. The angle he came out was just enough to keep him on track and maintain the lead. So I think we are seeing a very different Norris this season.
Yeah, I agree. I would say that for me, I've seen a different Lando Norris since Abu Dhabi last year, where he carried the team to that Constructors' Championship. He had seen his teammate taken out by Max Verstappen on that first lap. All the pressure was on him to carry the team with those two Ferraris breathing down his neck, and he didn't falter. And he told me that weekend that he had learnt the mistakes from the championship battle with Max, what he needed to be a world champion. And that was a different mentality. So for me, I think that change in mental approach had started at that point, and he had taken it over the winter, because he's come into this season as a favourite. Every single person, you know, you talk to is like, Lando's the favourite. And that brings pressure and expectation. And yet he seemed to just thrive under that this weekend. There was none of this trying to deflect and say, oh, no, someone else is quicker. Max is quicker than me. You know, he actually turned around and said, yeah, we have got the quickest car. And sort of he owned that position as the favourite and then delivered. As Beck mentioned, yeah, he had that moment where he went off, but then was able to recover. And he did so in a mature way without actually spitting feathers at his team or anything like that. You know, he just delivered. And I think that is what he needs to do now on a consistent basis. And yeah, to repeat back again, you know, the races that he shouldn't win, he should win. And if he manages to do that, then he'll be world champion at the end of it. So, you know, I think we are seeing a different Lando Norris this year.
And it was interesting because there was a bit of the old devil magic at work there that seems to always blight the chances of Australians on their home soil. It's gone on for so long now. It can't be anything other than some kind of devil magic. And Piastri was looking pretty solid at the very least to score some very solid points to sort of stay with Norris, because his only chance really this year is to be consistent. He didn't have that consistency last year. But I think the thing about top Grand Prix drivers, I don't know if you agree, is that you have to look at the picture and say, you know, we've got the car to do it this year. We don't know what's going to be the story next year. And they didn't have the car to do it this time last year. It evolved into that. And they kind of didn't get the Drivers' Championship, but they did get the Constructors. For me, if you're Norris now, if you're sitting in his seat, you're sitting there thinking, it has to be my way this year. Okay, it's going to be difficult to make it my way 24 times this year, but it has to be my way. And I don't think there's a better way of starting a season, particularly in those kind of conditions, than to stamp your authority on it the way he did. And the first indications of that, I think, were very interesting. Were right at the start, weren't they? When he was just very firm with Verstappen, where perhaps last year Verstappen might have given him a bit more manners.
The start was really interesting, I thought. It was a little bit here, a little bit there, defending from Piastri, defending from Verstappen. It wasn't going too wild either way. It was a very clever defence to then be leading into turn one.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, he, as I say, he's sort of set the tone for the weekend, and hopefully that's for the season going forward. You know, they're still mates. They're still joking in the press conference. Let's see how long that lasts.
0.8 seconds between Norris and Verstappen. It's that kind of tantalising, teasing us that perhaps this might be the season we're about to get. It certainly feels like it.
I thought you were going to say 0.8 seconds is how long the jollity is going to last.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
There was a very touching bit of body language. There was quite a lot of touching body language during that race. We'll come on to Hadjar and Lewis Hamilton's father in a minute. But there was a very, I don't know if you noticed it in Parc Fermé, but he was with both his mother and father. His mum comes, this is Norris I'm talking about, his mum comes a few times a year looking like a sort of architect. She's a very classy sort of Belgian woman with her kind of very architect glasses, and she may be an architect for all I know, but anyway. And his father, though, is a kind of an ever-present Adam, isn't he? He's kind of highly driven, very wealthy guy, sort of tech guy. He was part of the Hargreaves Lansdowne setup, you know. He's a brainy guy. But there was a side to him I haven't seen when they were standing together in the and Lando was in the park filming, and he was kissing his head repeatedly. Which as a father is a really interesting thing to do to a sort of 26 or whatever he is year old Grand Prix driver who's just tamed a machine in impossibly difficult circumstances. I thought that was really very interesting.
Ben and I were actually messaging about that, because I messaged Ben say I loved that Lando, the first thing he did when he won, you know, they normally run over to their teammates. The first thing he did is went and gave his mum a big hug. And I just thought, that's so lovely, isn't it? It really was a moment that they could celebrate together. But yeah, I noted his dad giving him a kiss. I mean, that's what I do to my four-year-old constantly, and he's forever pushing me away. But yeah, no, I hope that doesn't stop when they're in their 20s.
But he wasn't pushing him away, though, was he?
No, that's he wasn't. He was loving
thing.
It. He
was
like,
it was the most
it.
Natural thing. Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm not too sure how many of the victories his mum's been at, because obviously his dad and his mum missed the first one in Miami, and I remember we were there, Beck, weren't we, and we were watching him and all the celebrations. It did feel like something was missing, and it was that family aspect. And it was caught on Drive to Survive where he actually phoned his parents for the first time as a Grand Prix winner, so it was quite emotional. But lovely to see, you know, they are a good family. His sister was there as well this weekend as well, so a full family affair.
Do you remember, also I'll tell you a quick story. Remember in Vegas, the inaugural year, he had that massive crash, and we spoke to him at the next race, which that year was Abu Dhabi, and it was just Ben and I. We had every race have a little sit down with him, and I remember saying to him, oh, how's your mum doing after watching you in that crash? And I remember Norris, I'll bleep out myself, but he was like, yeah, she wasn't happy, basically. Yeah, you know, straight onto the phone to her, checking how I was, you know, being a real mum about it. And it was like, they're an incredibly close family, so it was really lovely to see after his win in Oz.
I think it was Nico Rosberg's mum that used to go and do the ironing or something when the racing was on.
Well, the worst I've seen in recent times, without shadow of doubt, is Grace Ricciardo. She's a lovely, lovely woman, Grace. But she really, I think she must have been the happiest day of her life was probably when he told her he was stopping first time round. And I bet she was dismayed when he said he was going to come back again with racing balls, because everything's twitching and shaking and she just doesn't like it at all.
I was on, do you remember when he won in Monaco? I remember being on the Red Bull Energy Station when they all came on and talking about kissing your grown-up child. I remember Grace being on the barge waiting for him to come, and as he came in she ran up to him, gave him a massive hug and just wouldn't let go of him and was just like kissing him all over, you know, like rural Italian style as they are. And it was absolutely wonderful to see. I love seeing those celebrations when they get to enjoy it with their family and their parents.
Well, someone who wasn't celebrating too much then was Oscar Piastri in the other McLaren. The key thing for Piastri, as I said earlier, is consistency this year. A lot of people think he's got a higher ceiling than Norris, which will be very interesting to see if that's true. He certainly would appear to be a sort of tougher customer, although Norris is showing this new side to him this year. So again, the situation is getting very, very interesting in terms of the psychology and the dynamics. But it's the worst start for Piastri from the point of view of not losing ground and being on the wrong side of team orders that, in my view, are going to be inevitable at some point this season. If there's an outside title threat, for sure McLaren this year, because as I said before, you don't know when your next championship winning car is going to come along. You have to get it done this year. And he does not want to be like multiple points behind Norris and be on the wrong side of that. And I think his body language after the race, you could really tell the dejection.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting was the amount of fans with Piastri shirts. You know, Ricciardo's absence has now left a void. I think Doohan's call up to Alpine obviously hasn't had such a same footprint as Piastri now in his third season and now a race winner. So he's sort of carrying those nations, the nation's expectations. But to be 23 points behind after one race is a huge amount when he looked nailed on for a podium. I think it's now about how he bounces back, and I think that he does have the mental capacity to do that. It would be really interesting to see how he goes in China, because I think they'll have the bit between his teeth and would look to make up for those lost points.
I think we should all calm down a little bit, to be honest. It's a 24 race season. It's incredibly long. We have no idea if Norris has the ability to be consistent throughout the whole season. There will be hiccups. We know that. McLaren, we know they're a championship winning side. We won the constructors, but it is a long old way to go. On the team orders point, I don't fully agree. I actually thought that was a very clever move to impose team orders, because they only did it because they were going through the back markers. And it was just a very sensible, don't race each other while you're overtaking the back markers. And then as soon as they were clear of those, it was you're free to race. And I think that's fair. From what I understand, there was a conversation had on Sunday morning. Well, they usually, you know, pre-brief, I should call it, on the Sunday morning of papaya rules, you're free to race, just don't mess it up. So I think they've taken quite a mature approach to it. I think Piastri is pretty ruthless. I think he'll bounce back. I think he'll be absolutely fine. Mark Webber, as his manager, knows all too well what it's like being that number two driver. No, I'm not calling Piastri a number two driver, to be clear, if Mark Webber is listening to this. But, you know, you bounce back, you get on with it, you accept it's a long season, you look at how close the field is, they're all going to be taking points off each other. So, yeah, you've just got to get back into it, put your boots back on, and we go racing again this weekend.
Indeed. The competitive balance then of the field, it pretty much underlined the readout that we got from testing. I think a lot of people were saying Ferrari is faster than they looked in qualifying on Saturday. Obviously, Sunday being wet, is you can't draw too many conclusions from it. But generally speaking, the readout of the kind of the competitive order was pretty accurate. McLaren looked like they're the fastest. They've got a few tenths on everybody else. The car is consistent. Looks like it's going to work in all kinds of different tracks and conditions. And Williams, I'd look like they've done well with their new car, which I think will give that group a lot of confidence.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it proved that the testing wasn't just a flash in the pan. It wasn't for sponsors. It was actually legitimate pace. I thought Carlos Sainz was very unlucky. He'd looked good all weekend until that rain happened and he slid off. But pleased for Alex Albon as well, because so much of the focus, pretty much like Ferrari with Hamilton going in there, you know, and the focus being on him and the original teammates sort of feeling a little bit in the shade, as it were. Whereas, same at Williams, lots of love for Carlos Sainz, but Alex Albon was the guy that did the job. And I was really pleased to see that on Sunday.
All right, well, let's get on to the rookies then, because that's such an interesting story. A very, very tough Sunday. I mean, when they opened their curtains after qualifying on Saturday for Sunday's race day, they knew it was going to rain. Everyone was predicting it. And of course, Melbourne being coastal, it is pretty much inevitable when you've got those weather forecasts that it's going to come off the sea, as it always does. The worst possible conditions, really, for inexperienced drivers: slippery track, white lines, walls aren't lining the track to hit. You can look a real idiot very, very quickly in that sort of situation. I guess some of them who crashed will take some relief that the most experienced man in the field, Fernando Alonso, with over 400 Grand Prix, also stacked it. Yeah. And obviously Carlos Sainz as well, who's Mr. Consistent, Mr. Smooth Operator, was not so smoothly into the barriers. But let's start with Isaac Hadjar. He didn't start, let alone didn't finish. And was warming up the tyres, got a surge and went into the barriers and couldn't stop crying. I mean, incredible scene. I was sitting there thinking, I feel sorry for you, but this is really not the way you should conduct yourself in your first Grand Prix. Helmut Marko put it a little bit more sternly, saying that it was embarrassing. Yeah. But then when he got back to the paddock, Anthony Hamilton put the hand round the shoulder and told him he'll to rise up and he'll have better days. What do you two, how do you two read this, and how much sympathy have you got for Isaac Hadjar?
I think the only thing that was embarrassing were Marco's comments, I have to say. I completely, completely disagreed with everything he said. If a guy wants to cry after his first race, so be it. Also, to be clear, we don't actually know if he was crying. He had his helmet on. He looked completely despondent. There was a reference made on Sky as the fact he was crying his eyes out. We don't actually know he was. And even if he was, so what? You know, you're allowed to cry. Absolutely devastating first end to not even starting a race. I think everyone just needs to take a step back. These guys are professional athletes, not robots. They are high on adrenaline. It must have been one hell of a come down for him. And the emotion is flowing. So I think, to be honest, people just need to move on from it. I think Marco, yeah, as I say, that was embarrassing what he said, as many things that he says are. And I thought what Anthony Hamilton did, rushing out to make sure he was okay, watching him walking down the paddock on his own, this lone figure, clearly absolutely devastated, and giving him a massive hug. And just for context, because they didn't really make it clear if anyone was watching, Hadjar is an enormous Lewis Hamilton fan, enormous, enormous. And the two of them have been kind of having social media messages and whatever in the run-up. And so it was really lovely. And to be honest, I think Anthony Hamilton just walked up to him as a father, looking at this young guy walking along, and just a bit like all of us, just wanted to give him a little hug, but was able to actually do it.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in between. I do feel that it was a really bad mistake after looking so good the previous day and over weekend, really. He did well. But, you know, yes, only he can explain how he felt. So the enormity of it all. And we don't know whether he was crying or not. It's rare that you see a driver come back into the paddock still with his helmet on, with his hands on his visor. Normally the grief had dissipated by then. I think the saddest thing for me was that it took Anthony Hamilton to go up and see the driver rather than anyone from the team waiting for him at the gate for him to come in, and there should have been someone there. I don't think Marco's comments were particularly helpful, as they often aren't, but maybe this is the get used to it sort of approach, because it's going to be like this every weekend. If he doesn't deliver, there will always be barbs pointing in his direction, as there should be for Liam Lawson, who we will probably come on to in a bit.
I mean, he had been the best of the qualifier amongst the rookies, which is quite something considering the cars that some of his the other rookies are driving. Kimi Antonelli finished fourth. He was fourth as he crossed the line, then he was penalised for the unsafe release. Ben, you're going to explain that to us in a moment. It was the best rookie result since 2014, memorable occasion. I was there when Magnussen finished second, and he is the second youngest point scorer ever. When you come into Formula One with the kind of anticipation and reputation that Kimi Antonelli has come with, you're replacing a seven-time world champion at a multiple champion team. That is the kind of result that you need to post on day one, and he did it.
I had him as captain in my fantasy team, so I was delighted. But it was an amazing result. It was. I mean, he is a proper cool cucumber. I was lucky enough to sit next to him at the Autosport Awards in January, and we were just chatting away. And he's a really lovely guy, really like normal guy. Again, good to go back to the conversation about family. He had both his parents there. If you could see, he was there for George Russell, his teammate, on the podium. He had his arms around his little sister, who was able to go out for the race as well. Super close to his family. He's a really, really, really nice kid with an enormous amount of pressure on him. So yeah, what a way to start his F1 career. A really sensible race for him as well. He had that tough outing in Monza last year where he was in FP1. He pushed it too hard. He crashed. And then 2 days later, Mercedes announced him as their full-time driver for this season, as we all expected. That's fine. You know, people crash. We saw Lewis Hamilton crash in his first outing with Ferrari. They're trying to find the limits of these cars. It happens. But it was a really sensible, head-screwed-on performance from Antonelli, I thought, and really impressive. And I'm glad, and I'm glad also Ben is explaining it, but I'm glad that he got that fourth place back, because he deserved it.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the actual penalty, it was the unsafe release. I can't even talk. I think this is the jet lag. He was released in front of Nico Hülkenberg. And obviously that usually triggers a penalty from the stewards. And it did in this instance, which obviously had demoted him when he crossed the line. And it was a shame, really, because his joy at finishing fourth was tempered by that radio message, which was, you know, denied us the reaction that we should have got. But then, yes, Mercedes had a right of appeal, right of review. Try saying that after no sleep. And which they were able to take new evidence, and it was the video on the roll hoop camera, which we haven't used before. It's part of the new broadcasting equipment that Formula One have brought in, and they were able to identify, along with an explanation, which the stewards were able to take into account. I believe they also used, did they use footage from the helicopter as well? So yeah, it was a bit of everything that they looked together and they made a case, and they agreed that he shouldn't have been penalised. So yeah, quite a lengthy process, but one to see that it does actually work and that they are able to use the equipment to get the right decision, in my opinion.
Well, my 92-year-old dad, who, as you know, is an old racer himself, was incandescent at the idea that the driver should be penalised for an unsafe relief, because it's not his fault.
Well, that's,
the team
well,
sort of, he said, yeah, by all means, fine the team, which, of course, he used to do, but he said it's nuts to penalise the driver. And I have to say, I think he's right. I'm glad that in this case it was turned over, but I do think that's something that is needs to be thought about, because it really isn't the driver's fault if you get released into the path of other people. Looking at the other rookies then, there's not so much to say about Ollie Bearman. Finished 14th. Doohan crashed early on, didn't finish.
Bearman, I would suggest, he had a torrid weekend all the way through, didn't he? He duffed it into the barriers and span off, and he had a really miserable time. But ultimately, he brought the car home in the race. So, I think that is a case of learning over the weekend. And we should obviously make the point that no one had done any testing on these tyres in these conditions. So, fair play to Ollie Bearman for bringing it home.
Absolutely. And Bortoleto also didn't finish. But interestingly, with Bortoleto in the Sauber, he out-qualified Hülkenberg at the first attempt in good conditions, normal conditions, which I think is quite interesting in itself and definitely a little marker, because Hülkenberg can be massively fast. And obviously, he brought the car home, got the points, which will help Sauber. I think it took them 23 races or something to score a point last year, and they've already got one on the board at the first attempt, which is great. But keep an eye on Bortoleto. I've been saying it all through the winter. For me, he's right up there amongst the most talented of these rookies.
I agree. He came in under the radar, despite his excellent performance in the junior categories and what he did last year. I think he's definitely one to watch.
Then we have Lawson, who also didn't finish in the Red Bull when his teammate Verstappen finished second. In fact, we've had a question from one of our listeners, Andy, on X, who said, at what point do we admit that Marco just hates Yuki Tsunoda? For whatever reason, I'm a McLaren fan, but even from here, it's obvious who should be in the second Red Bull seat. Should be Tsunoda and not Lawson. So do you agree with Andy?
I don't think he hates, but it is difficult to make a case, isn't it? I think that there's so much pressure on Red Bull as a team to take the juniors rather than someone like Tsunoda, who's come a different route, shall we say, that they want to stick with that production line to almost justify Helmut Marko's role in that and for keeping that operation going. I think that there will be a time this year where there'll be a big decision for Red Bull to make, whether it's to promote Tsunoda into that senior team role. Liam Lawson definitely struggled at the weekend, and it's big pressure. For me, all I kept thinking is, I wonder what Sergio Perez is making of all this. I'd love to know.
Exactly. Rebecca, let's do Ferrari now then. Lewis Hamilton finished 10th in Melbourne, two places behind his teammate who overtook him. Lewis was out-qualified last year by George Russell 15-9, which is pretty unprecedented in his career. So qualifying going into this year was always a key area we were going to be watching closely with Leclerc, who's a super qualifying. And it was first blood to Charles with a margin of 0.2. Lewis didn't look too despondent about that, and saying that considering how little time he's had learning the new ways of Ferrari, that he doesn't have the DNA of the car completely worked out yet. Leclerc's got 7 years of institutional knowledge of Ferrari. He actually thought 0.2 was a pretty fair margin. How do you judge his first Ferrari outing, Rebecca?
I mean, certainly not what he would have wanted. Strategy mistake eventually cost him. We saw him leading the race at one point, legitimately leading it as well as others pitted to the weather conditions were changing. The rain was starting to fall. He was on slicks. Others were pitting for the Inters. It was a gamble as to whether or not they stayed out. What they should have done is either stick with their decision on slicks and see if the gamble could pay off and if the drivers could hold on for a couple of laps of the rain. But what they ended up doing was actually solidifying their mistake and just not making a decision. You know, no decision is as bad as making a bad decision, sort of thing. So it was a mess towards the end for him. He was really happy at the start of the weekend. Ben can talk to this better having spoken to him, but, you know, he was really happy, really open with the media. And as the weekend went on, it was getting a bit tougher. And then by the end of it on Sunday night, you know, he was saying he just didn't get the information that he wanted. We heard it over the radio as well, didn't we, with Ricardo Adami, his new race engineer. You know, 12 years with Bono, Pete Bonington at Mercedes, and now he's having to not only learn Ferrari, new team, new car, but new race engineer. That relationship, it's such an important relationship between driver and engineer. They are the only people, the engineer who gets to speak to the drivers. All information is relayed. Drivers want different amounts of information. Lewis basically doesn't want any unless he asks for it, and kept having to say to Ricardo Adami, leave me to it. I don't care. Like, why are you telling me this? I don't get it. And was actually very nice about him afterwards, saying, look, he did a good job. He's just learning my way of doing it. I'm learning his way of doing it. We'll get there. But he clearly wasn't a very happy bunny come Sunday night. It certainly was not the fairy tale outing with Ferrari that he had wanted. That dream of an eighth world championship feels like it's already gone. And I know I was the one talking earlier about calm down, it's 24 races. but it's, you know, looking at the table already. I mean, even for Ferrari, it's a tricky ordeal. You're looking at McLaren in the Constructors' Championship. They're on 27 points. Mercedes on 27 points. Ferrari only scored 5 points in Australia. It was a really bad weekend for them. Qualifying, they weren't great. I think 7th and 8th. And then, you know, finishing in the race with Lewis 10th. And it was a bad weekend for Ferrari all round. And those issues, okay, it wasn't reliability. The car worked. And we saw that they had pace, particularly in practice. But, you know, it just, they cannot afford to be making any mistakes when we've got the likes of McLaren who don't make any mistakes.
It was a healthy dose of reality, wasn't it, for Lewis coming into that team, and it being a strategy blunder, which ultimately cost him. And I think, yeah, he was frustrated. He wanted more, tried what he could. That relationship, I think, with the race engineer is going to be key, and it's all going to be played out over the next couple of races. But it's all part of the refinement process. I do think that this year was already too soon to talk about a world championship for Hamilton. It's all about building for 26, by which stage he'll be 41. So, you know, I'm not sure. You know, will he still have the ability? We will not know. But for me, it's all part of a longer term picture. And that this is all part of the process. He's got to go through this healing and resolving and fixing before they can come out the other side.
The interesting thing, you talk about the strategy blunder, and my feeling at the time and still is that what people sometimes do in a situation like that. So, for example, if Williams had been in that position with their two drivers, James Vowles isn't the strategist there anymore, but he's a very experienced strategist from his Mercedes days. What you might have seen a team like that do is split them and hedge your bets. So one car would do the plan A and the other one would do the opposite and put the intermediates on. And then you've got a foot in both camps, depending on what happens next with the rain. You're not sure how intense it's going to get. And I was really surprised initially that Ferrari didn't do that. And then I suddenly thought, well, actually, maybe they just do not want to put themselves in a position where they're going to have to, at the end of the race, accept that one of them got a huge advantage from that decision. And it's a coin toss as to which way you go. They actually, I don't know whether they avoided that and would rather take a bad result for both cars than already set themselves up with a bit of this going on between the two drivers. Whereas I fancy a Williams might, you know, with Albon and Sainz would have just said, right, we're going to do this. We're going to be pragmatic and one of you is going to really win out from this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a valid point. You know, that's going to be the thing that Vasseur's got to manage over the next 23 races, that relationship and finding a way of working it. We mentioned team orders with regards to McLaren. Just how awkward is that going to be at Ferrari to ask one driver to allow another one to pass? And the moment that does happen, and it's obviously quite clear, it's going to cause a bit of a stink. So, yes, that's going to happen at some point. Let's see when it comes.
So away from the racetrack then, a couple of other things coming out of the start of the season that I'm interested in and I'd like to talk about is behind the scenes. We saw Stefano Domenicali, former boss of Ferrari, Formula One team, of course, been the CEO of Formula One now since 2021. And he's just signed a new 5-year contract that'll take him into his early 60s. Clearly, Liberty Media have got complete confidence in Stefano. I'm sure a lot of Formula One has, and a lot of the teams have very much come out to support him. And hot on the heels of that, he confirmed that all the 11 teams that will compete in 2026, of course, that includes Cadillac, who are coming in, have now signed the Concorde commercial agreement, securing the participation of all the key actors, basically, in the sport. That is one of those things that in a weekend like Melbourne, with all that goes on, can be sort of forgotten about or sort of slightly swept under the carpet. But that, from a point of view of F1 stability going forward, Rebecca, is a massive pillar for the future.
I mean, it's great that they've all signed up to it, particularly with Cadillac coming in. We obviously know that that was a bit of a fraught entry, not necessarily supported by all players involved. So great that they've got the Concorde agreement sorted. I know Ben was chasing it over the weekend. We were going to get it. We weren't going to get it. We were going to get it. We weren't going to get it. And then we got it. But it's not all done and dusted. We're obviously now waiting on the FIA side. And I'm not entirely clear what the delay is, other than there always seems to be one on the FIA side. Ben?
Well, the reason why we had it and we didn't have it and we had it and we didn't have it is because every time we had it, I went to the FIA, because this is a three-party agreement which links the teams, F1 and the FIA together. I knew two of the bits had been done. When I went back to the FIA and said, what's the deal? There were nothing. We don't know. There's nothing planned, nothing on our radar. So it was really interesting when it was announced and there was a big hole in that three-party agreement, which is the FIA, and they were almost caught in the dark. And I think that is the wider picture, is that it really does smash the ball back into the FIA's court in terms of, you know, the message from F1 and the teams is, let's get this Concorde agreement done. We need it. It's a matter of urgency now. We need it in place. You know, come on, sign up, bring it all together. The issue being the FIA president wasn't in Melbourne. He's not expected to be at a race until Bahrain. You know, so we've still got China this week off, then Japan, and then Bahrain. So we're still some way away. But the message is clear. We want this all done. We need to move forward. I'm not sure what the holdup is. I can only presume that there is some sort of bargaining. I think that judging by the people who I spoke to on the ground in Australia, they were saying that the FA was surprised that the teams would agree a commercial deal with F1 at this stage. And he, I should say the FIA and the FIA president had felt that they may have dug their heels in a little bit longer in the hope of getting a better deal. So it may be a case that this two-party agreement so far has definitely caught the FIA napping.
I have to say I find this a little bit surprising because when I was in the Bahrain at the test, I was hearing that they were pretty close to agreeing the commercial elements. There was a little bit of I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed. But the big piece is like, you know, Ferrari's kind of extra payment for history and the dilution figure for that Cadillac would pay, which I believe is $450 million, that basically compensates for the fact that the other 10 teams are going to have to share the prize money between them with an extra player in there. You know, those kind of things were pretty much the last knockings. And yet there had been no governance proposal put forward by the FIA at that point. And that's what, 2.5 weeks ago or something. But clearly this thing didn't come from nowhere. It was, so it makes you wonder what their kind of intelligence in terms of intelligence gathering from the point of view of the FIA's president, you know, it shouldn't really be a surprise to him that the teams in Formula One are about to sign an agreement. And you can't really imagine, you know, a Jean Todt or a Max Mosley in the past as an FIA president not being aware of exactly what the picture was and the timing was. So it's a really interesting situation. And I think what we all need to keep an eye on here is how long it takes for the other piece to fall into place. Because if this sort of drags on through the spring and even into the early summer, then it starts to become quite an interesting standoff and quite an interesting I wouldn't use the word crisis because I never use the word crisis, but it starts to become a real talking point.
Yeah, and it's knowing why we're at this position. How has it got this way? And what's the FAA holding out for? What is the goal for them? That's really what I would like to find out.
Yeah, well, power and money normally are two of the things that people hold out for, but we don't know which way the balance on those things is. But I think it's going to be very, very interesting to observe that over time.
Power is already sort of, you know, taken out of the equation, isn't it? At the moment, we're looking at an uncontested election for the president. So, and the way that those sort of, you know, the governance has been changed over the last couple of weeks would imply that he still has the power, but perhaps it's the other part of the equation that you'd mentioned.
It's a three-dimensional chess game, and we shall follow it with great interest. We'll wrap it up there. Please do remember to make your voice heard by completing the Global F1 Fan Survey. You can find the link in the episode description notes. We've been tens of thousands of responses to that. It's absolutely fascinating, the data that's coming back, and it carries on. And also, you can join our fast-growing Fantasy League. Bec, you were mentioning this earlier on. Tell us all about it.
Well, I've not had a very good weekend, if I'm totally honest. But yes, you can race our writers and join our league, motorsport.com. We're one of the featured leagues on F1 Fantasy webpage. You can set up your team. It's really difficult. The budget cap makes it very hard. I didn't have a good weekend, I have to say, apart from Antonelli. That's my only crowning glory. But yes, we would love you to join us in there. It has all of the writers from across the network, both motorsport and autosport. And you can see how you're getting on.
Well, we'll put the link also in the episode description notes, and please do sign up to that. And again, that's become very, very popular in the last few weeks. My thanks to Rebecca and Ben. You can read all the latest news and insights on F1 on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. My thanks to Dre, Ben and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe. Leave us a review and a rating, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We love seeing new listeners discovering the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audion Atom, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audion Atom is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audion Atom has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audion Atom to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audion Atom is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audion Atom, you can hear life again.